tonight on Arena. In movies, we review Hollow Road, Good One, and a docudrama about Eileen Gray. And Gail Bellum tells us the story of vanilla in her new novel, The Rarest Fruit. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Tonight, four film reviews for you. Not a sequel or a prequel or a remake in sight. Not bad for a sunny evening in May, is it? Be warned, though, you may well be questioning your parenting skills after the next 20 minutes or so. In Good One, first-time director India Donaldson brings us on a daddy-daughter road trip with stressful undertones. Indie darling Chloe Sevigny stars in Magic Farm as a narcissistic film crew faces challenges in rural Argentina. We bring you a fascinating look at the house E1027, the architecture legacy of pioneering Irish designer Eileen Gray. It's a new feature docudrama, hybrid that we'll be talking about there. Serena Bellissimo and John Maguire are with me in studio. But we'll start this evening with Hollow Road, thriller, chiller, starring Rosamund Pike and Matthew Rhys, which is filmed in County Wicklow. Parents Maddie and Frank go on the worst car journey of their lives as they race to get to their daughter, who has caught a terrible terrible accident. This really is, Serena, nightmare stuff. And so tense from the outset.
From the very beginning. And I think there's only three different scene changes, and most of the time you're in the car with the parents and you think, how can you sustain a film for this long and keep my interest? Oh my gosh, I was on edge the whole time. And it's not just that whole claustrophobic thing, because, I mean, we've seen it before, done really brilliantly. Do you remember Buried with Ryan Reynolds in 2010?
Yeah. Stephen Knight did a great film called Lock as well.
I haven't seen
Tom
that one
Hardy,
yet.
Which is the same thing.
And
all
Phone
set
Booth
in a car.
With Colin Farrell. Phone Booth, another one of them.
There's another one.
Yeah. And look, when you're doing something like this, it's taking a massive risk, right? So you have to make sure that the actors you call on are really good. Rosamund Pike and Matthew Rhys, we'll get to them later because they are fabulous. But can we have a moment for Megan McDonnell, who plays the daughter? We never see her. We don't see the scene of, and that's the other thing, you don't see the scene of the crime. But she is incredible.
She's the one on the other end of the phone.
I wish they would give Oscars or awards for voice talent, because she'd win it for
maybe,
me, hands
maybe
down.
They will. Well, you may start a craze. Let's have a listen to a clip which features, you'll hear her in the distance, Megan O'Donnell here on the phone, Matthew Rhys and Rosamund Pike as Frank and Maddie, the two parents, get that phone call from their daughter, and they know from the very beginning they're in trouble here and they need to do something.
Okay. Listen. I'm going to come to you. Mum and I are going to drive over to you, all right? So just stay on the phone.
No, she needs to be on the phone with the operator.
No, with you. To you, Matt, not some other paramedic. Stay on the phone until the ambulance arrives.
Alice, how long is the ambulance going to be? How long did they say? Where are you? Okay, I'm coming.
There you go. You really do get a sense of the panic of Matthew Rhys and Rosamund Pike there as the two parents of the young girl on the end of the phone. But as we were saying, as we're listening to that, yes, that's the beginning. But as they're in the car, we get a really good sense of Megan O'Donnell's voice, John.
Yeah, we do, Sean. This is from Babak Anvari, is the director here, and he's a British Iranian, and it's his most effective film since. He made a sensational debut with a film called Under the Shadow, a horror movie. And this is about as spare and as lean as a film can be. The setup is simplicity itself. Mm. They get the call. Just prior to the phone ringing and waking up Maddie, the Rosamund Pike character, we get a little glimpse through the room, through the kitchen. There's a half-finished meal on the table. There's a broken glass on the floor. We see her ID card that identifies her as a paramedic. In 40 seconds, a run through the room with the camera. Then they get into the car and they're on the way to Hollow Road. She's on the phone, the daughter, freaking out. And the two of them are faced with a moral question. What do we do? She's a paramedic. Call the ambulance. He's thinking, because of something that we're not going to reveal, because there's very little, word here now and you could spoil the whole thing.
You could spoil the whole film.
He's thinking, how am I going to protect my daughter? And she's thinking, how am I going to save the person's life that she's knocked down with the car on this remote, out-of-the-way road? And they're both faced with a question. How are we going to construct a lie? They have to come up with a story in order to save their daughter from the repercussions of being involved in an accident. And again, she's not been entirely forthright with them about her sobriety and her state of mind. And they are, in, as it unfolds in real time over the 90 minutes or so, they're faced with this question, you know, what do we do? What lie are we going to tell? How are we going to create a story?
Will we? Because that's the thing as well.
Yeah, because it's the question.
Yeah, it's a moral dilemma.
They find themselves in a moral dilemma here. That's precisely it. And I suppose that's part of the tension too. It's that debate that they're having in the confines of the car.
We've got to do the right thing. As they work their way through it, their marriage isn't in the greatest shape, and they're working that out as well.
Sabrina?
It's like, you know those fairy tales now that are all sweet and great, but, you know, when they were written, was it the Brothers Grimm, when they wrote their fairy tales, they were all really grim. This feels like a bit of that where, you know...
And there is that folk horror feel, there's a twist.
And this is the thing, so there is a twist which we won't talk about, so like you're watching it, it's really intense, really intense, and so I feel like I'm in that Ryan Reynolds movie, and then I feel like they've literally taken a turn and we're in an M. Night Shyamalan movie. It has a bit, and so then it sort of lost me a little bit, but even having said that, at the end, I wasn't upset it went where it went. I was still a bit confused by why it was going there, but it was still a powerful enough movie for me to go, you need to see this. And the fact that it comes in at 80 minutes, can we give it a round of applause for tying it up in 80 minutes?
An 80-minute movie always gets an extra star from me, Sean. You know. But I will say that what you're focused on here, the story is the story. It's as spare and as brisk it could be. He's doing so much with so little.
Yeah.
There's really very little here. But it's the performances from Pike and Reese that intensity.
And Maggie MacDonald as the other end of the phone.
Exactly. And there's two other people on the phone as well. We don't know much about that.
We don't want to talk about that.
But they're just sitting in a car. Yeah. And the fact that they can draw a story, and as the cliche says, it's the film that's happening in your head is much more frightening than what you're seeing on screen.
All right, starts from you on this one, Serena.
I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5.
A 4 from you, and John?
A 3 from me, Sean. I had a good time. And we were talking about the twist and the direction it goes in. Up to that point, I was enjoying it. After that point, I was enjoying it all the more.
And
I would like to have seen more of that.
And you gave it a 3.
Well, there you go. 3 is worth going out to see.
You're not, without, again, we can't obviously go into the ending, but you were kind of a little bit at sea with it, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, Serena.
It's not, but just expect it to go off in different directions, which is good too.
Yeah, all right. That is Hollow Road, first of our movies this evening. Let's move on then to Good One, debut feature from director India Donaldson about a father-daughter hiking trek. Again, parenting very much to the fore in this one. John, father-daughter hiking trick with the pal.
Yeah.
Not sure. Would that work as an elevator pitch? Are you in? Are you hooked from that?
Well, it would have been if it was a Raymond Carver story. A Raymond Carver story right there. It's Ginderbine, the Ray Lawrence movie from a couple of years ago. That would call to mind. You might even think of Boorman's Deliverance. Now, there's nothing in this film that approaches that kind of horror. But there's horror here, too. I mean, this is about how awful it is to be a child, a 17-year-old young lesbian New Yorker about to go off to college. And she's dragged away by her father, who she's got a kind of an estranged relationship with, and his horrible friend, who's, you know, they've been friends for years and years. And his father, her father doesn't even see how awful this man is. His own son wouldn't go with them. And, you know, it's that kind of itchy horror. It's not just about the horrors of being a child of a bad or a struggling parent, but it's about how horrible it is to be a parent as well.
James Gross is the dad. Danny McCarthy is the pal, man called Matt. And newcomer Lily Collias is Sam.
Yeah. So this is a 3-day camping trip in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York. They make their way along the trail. They get to where they're going. They make their way along the trail. The two old friends start up their usual arguments and bickering and the nonsense and that routine that you imagine has been going on forever.
Right.
And Sam, who's quiet and reserved, has to try to deal with these two men out in the middle of nowhere.
Let's listen to some of the chats are quite short, and this is a little clip from the trailer. But you get a sense of, you know, you don't need your dad talking to you like this, I think, in front of his pal.
I don't think I've ever seen you eat this much.
This is a regular amount of food.
I didn't even know you ate meat.
Yeah, I thought you were a vegetarian.
I've never been a vegetarian, Dad.
You seem like one, though.
There you go. Is it your dad's? Her dad that says, or you seem like a vegetarian? You know,
no, that's the friend.
Oh, that's the friend. Well, that's the beginning of put him in his place, please, Dad, immediately.
Okay, yeah, but they don't. Yeah, that's the whole...
Sorry, Serena, come in there.
Yeah. I view this a bit differently, though, because I look at... when you're talking about parenting, I look at my kids and the way they are with my friends, and I start off with, isn't this lovely? I hope I get to a point where I can go on a hike with my kid and one of my friends, and, you know, it's about chosen family and how you treat them and the fact that, you know, your friends look at your kids as their kids too. But then it goes on and you go, oh, this 17-year-old girl really, like, they do have a lovely, they have a relationship, right? But then you realise it's actually the 17-year-old needs a father. She is the father's mother. She is doing the mothering of both the father and the friend. Now, it is a bit of a horror, but I have to say, this is one of the most beautiful, meditative films I have seen. Like, sometimes I felt like...
It looks beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, but even just watching it, I felt like, you know when you go to a spa and you have that spa music happening? I felt like this was the visual version of being in a spa.
Not, you're not talking about Muzak in the... But you're talking about...
No.
Because one of the things about this, John, I think is... It's tiny little details that India Donaldson, first time director,
Daughter of Roger Donaldson, the veteran Kiwi director.
Yeah. All right, so she's picking up. She's just. It's almost like a fly on the wall.
Yeah. Very
the way she uses.
Yeah.
uses her camera
is really clever. But it's also the sound design is gorgeous in this film as well. She knows when silence is required and how to fill that silence with the sounds of nature and the birdsong. And like Serena says, it has that meditative quality to it. Rushing water, insects. And there's long sequences when nothing really seems to happen. And that soothing rhythm really in the film makes the tensions then, when they come, all the more palpable, when they inevitably crack. And the tension really here is all about realizing the limitations of other people, even people like your parents, who you may have held in a certain light throughout your life, only to see them in a different light when that light changes. And that's really interesting.
And I suppose it's important to point out, because when you do hear the hiking trip and you think, oh yeah, it's going to be a Deliverance style kind of awfulness in this. There is horror here, but is it a psychological type of horror rather than any physical? We don't see anything awful or have to deal with awful actions being done to people.
And that's the thing, right? Sometimes the horror can be in the small stuff, because no, we don't see horrible actions being done to people, but just because there's no horrible actions per se, it doesn't mean that the way you're being treated is right.
Yeah.
And it's funny how you see that the lived experience of the daughter, who's obviously a female in this case, and the father, who is a male, they have very different lived experiences. So, you know, when she goes to her father with something, he brushes it off. But as a female watching that, you're like, no, it's actually
grim. There's a suggestion made at a certain point that you would expect the man to jump in and defend his daughter, and he doesn't. Yeah. And that's the crux of the film.
Yeah. Okay. Stars from you on this one, Serena?
Yeah, I give this a 4 as well. It's beautiful. As scary as it sounds, I think it's. Do you know what it is as well? It's a time for you to sort of pause and take a breath while you're watching this. And it's so original, and more of this. And it's done in 90 minutes. Another star job.
Another 90 minute film.
We got away with it this week.
Yeah, and clearly,
I really
India
enjoyed
Donaldson
it as well.
Sean, to watch here. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, and Collius, actually, the Lily Collius, who's a relative newcomer, she's a very fine performance here. That's a very expressive face, and that kind of watchfulness in the character as well, showing every flicker of emotion. That's really involving for a relative newcomer. So it's 4 stars for me as well, Sean. It's a good movie.
Right, okay. Yeah. A double 4 there for what is it called? It is called Good One. Let us move on then to E10-7, Eileen Gray and the House by the Sea. You've seen this one, John.
Yes.
Pioneering Irish architect and designer. I mean, many people will be aware of her, but this house, E10-7, is hugely important.
Yeah.
I'm calling it a feature, but there's a kind of a...
It's a mix,
docudrama,
it's a hybrid,
style to it,
it's
is there?
Biography drama, archive footage, and recreated docudrama, I suppose. It's a hybrid from two Swiss filmmakers, Beatrice Minger and Christoph Schaub, who's made a number of documentaries about architects and architecture. And like you say, Sean, it's the story of Eileen Gray, furniture designer and architect, one of the leading lights in modernism, one of the first female furniture designers, certainly of any note, and one of the first female architects in Europe. And the crux of the film is a three-way split that developed between herself, as played by the Irish actress Natalie Radmel Quirk, and her Romanian lover, John Badovici, who's an actor, played by an actor who luxuriates under the name Axel Mustache, and the acclaimed architect Le Corbusier, played by Charles Morillon, over the building of this beautiful villa on a cliff off Cap Martin in the French Riviera in the late 1920s. Now, the building is a real building. Had, after Grey left, after this three-way split had its way, we'll get into that, it fell into dereliction and it was rescued by a group of in France and restored, and it's now a museum. And they filmed a lot of this film in the building itself. But it's that split that develops between them when Le Corbusier shoulders his way into this relationship and then tries to take over. And years later, actually, when anybody ever said, attributed the building to Le Corbusier, he didn't correct them, even though he had nothing to do with it.
All right. Well, let's listen to a clip that features, as you mentioned, Natalie Radmill Quirk playing the part of Eileen Gray. And she's talking here about the impact that the house had on Le Corbusier.
In the 1920s, men built the world to meet their own needs. I wanted to create a space for the woman. And then I could conceive of a different world. Le Corbusier was intrigued.
Cette maison est fascinante. Elle a réussi quelque chose de singulier. Mais pourquoi vous construisez des murs blancs si ce n'est pas dans le but de les recouvrir de peinture?
The house took possession of him.
Et j'exige.
That's Le Corbusier talking about the white walls. That's in the scene.
He covered them in these kind of vaguely erotic, colourful murals that were still there when the squatters had it all through the 70s and 80s and are still there now in the museum, even though they were not part of Gray's original plan. But the film, I suppose, is an attempt, Sean, to understand the drama that took place in the house and the different forces at play, but also how all of that manifested from the point of view of art and creation. Like, Gray lived a long, happy life.
And do we get a good sense of her and how she forged this career for herself?
I think we do.
Separately
yes.
from Le Corbusier, who may have wanted to claim all sorts
that's
of things.
Precisely,
about,
that's precisely, really the best thing about the film, is that Gray has been in films before, and Mary McCaughey made a film, The Price of Desire, about her. There's been documentaries made about her, and she's a well-studied figure. But we don't know much about her. And the film, some of the best material in the film is an attempt to understand who she was, where she came from, and what drove her to do what is extraordinary work, absolutely beautiful work. So, for all of that, and it's such a sexy setup, and it's a story of geniuses betraying one another in one way or another in the roaring 20s. The actual film itself is a rather dry and slightly academic affair. It's slightly inert, and there's a certain lack of passion in it, I found. But so 3 stars, it's worth seeing, and certainly if you're a fan of Grey's, it's well worth seeing.
All right, okay. Let us move on then to our final film of the night, Magic Farm. A chaotic American documentary crew in the rural wilds of Argentina is the setup here. Chloe Sevigny, as Serena here, is getting back into her indie It Girl roots. Tell us the story that we've been told here.
Let me tell you what Amalia Ullman, who is the writer, director behind this,
says the story is.
Yeah, so can I tell you that? Because I was so confused when I was watching it. She said that she wanted to try and tell a story about how making the world smaller hasn't widened our curiosity as much as it's shrunk it into tiny, snarky bites. In short, it's about going everywhere and seeing nothing, right? So this documentary crew turn up to a rural town in Argentina to tell this story. They got the town wrong. They got the story wrong. So while they were there, they were trying to make up a story to tell. As the story they're making up, as this unfolds, behind them, there is a real health crisis going on that they are not opening their eyes to, because they just are so zoned in on the story they have to tell. The performances in this are great.
Chloe Sevigny, she's the filmmaker, a woman called Edna.
Yeah, and she's annoying, right? But that's what she's
supposed to be.
She's brilliant in this. I cannot fault the acting. I cannot fault the cinematography. Like, it is beautifully shot.
There's a very big butt coming at the end of this.
There is. It just feels like, I was saying to John earlier, it feels like this is a college production where someone was told, here are the points you have to hit, go and make an indie type film. I'm going to give you a little bit, a limited budget, go see what you can do with it. It just felt like it had so much potential. and it just didn't strike gold.
All right, let's listen to a clip. Chloe Sevigny's Queen Bee filmmaker Edna. Her colleague Jeff is here having a chat, played by Alex Wolfe, the character of Jeff. There's a new intern called Nora. They're not quite sure about her, but she does have one particular skill that they're going to mention towards the end of this. And a bit of language as they go along.
Everything is complicated enough as it is. I hired you to help me. Instead, you're just making things worse.
Well, come on, everyone loves you. You're the face of the fucking company. You can't do anything wrong.
Exactly. My face, my responsibility.
You're right. I screwed up. I shouldn't have trusted frickin' Nora.
Well, duh, she's an intern. And how old is she, 18?
She's 20. She's very mature. She's an unbelievable knitter.
Knitter?
She's an unbelievable knitter.
Oh, my God.
And does the knitting play any role in
all of
this, Serena?
We never see her again, so she's been left in New York. Nora has been left in New York. It's just, no, the knitting is just a by-part of that conversation. It's very frustrating. As I said, it could have been so much better. I went in going, yay, 90 minutes. This is going to be great. I felt every minute of that 90 minutes. I was like, oh, are we not over yet?
And so this was a 90-minute film that overstayed its welcome at 90 minutes.
It really did. I just, do you know, I feel like we're seeing the first draft. Like, this is the draft that Amalia Ullman handed to her professor, and then her professor should have come back and gone, well, here's a couple of suggestions, or the editor, but as I said, it felt like a college film. So here's a couple of suggestions, and let's go do a second draft. So I just feel like if this was workshopped a bit more,
sounds like the performances really are what's worth seeing here, if there's anything worth seeing.
Yeah, and her intention behind this film, I love
good.
It. Yeah, yeah it yeah. just it just fell short when it came to making it.
All right. Stars on that then?
Oh, I'm going to be really kind. I'm going to give it 2.5.
And that's kind.
Yeah.
Glad you weren't mean. This is Serena Bellissimo speaking to us there about Magic Farm, and she and John McGuire previously speaking to us about Hallow Road, which goes on general release tomorrow, and Good One, E1027, Eileen Gray and the House by the Sea, and Magic Farm will be in selected cinemas from tomorrow. Vanilla is a flavour we may take for granted now, but 200 years ago, the plant was impossible to pollinate outside of South America. The 12-year-old slave, Edmund Albius, changed all of that in the 1840s when he made a breakthrough on the plantation where he lived in La Reunion, French-speaking island in the Indian Ocean. He didn't get the credit for it at the time, of course. He'd succeeded where many eminent botanists had failed, but he was a young black slave. He wasn't a white botanist, let us face that is the crux of the matter here. His story is told in The Rarest Fruit, the latest novel from Gail Bellum, an author who comes herself from La Reunion. Her fiction is translated into English by Irish publisher Bolon Press. That's Bolon Press. The English edition of her previous novel, her debut novel, There's a Monster Behind the Door, has just won Bolon the prestigious Republic of Consciousness Prize for small presses. I'm delighted that Gail Bellum is with me in studio this evening. Let us find out a little bit more about La Reunion and the island that you grew up on, which is, it sounds odd to me, it's part of France. It is ruled by France to this day.
Yes, indeed. Reunion, you know, is a former French colony, now is a department, and it's one of the brightest islands of the Indian Ocean.
When you say that it is a department, what does department mean? Do your laws come from France? Does everything, rules come from France?
Yes, I would say that it's the same thing between Great Britain and Ireland. Both need each other. France have, of course, recognized slavery, colonialism, but the relationship between La Réunion and France still look like a modern colonialism. La Réunion has many competitive advantages, but it depends on France for most of things because its insularity, its geographical location far from France, its remoteness and small size make it depend too much on France, maybe.
Tell me about the island as it was, the island you grew up in as a young girl, a young woman, because you then went off to Paris to go to college.
Yes, indeed. I had a quiet childhood spent with my parents and my brother in a small town at the east of La Réunion. We spent our time, like most of children, playing outside in a huge garden, going to the river. We used to eat many tropical fruits like lychees, pineapples, mangoes. You know, where you are a child, you are happy with simple things.
You mentioned those fruits, which sound so exotic to me. I mean,
it's normal for us.
Yeah, so in Ireland, in the autumn time, we go down and we pick blackberries off the bushes. But you were picking...
And we do the same thing.
With these fruits.
With mango, with pineapples.
Yeah, so you just went down and there they were growing wild, not cultivated by a farmer or by a fruit
both,
grower.
Both, yes.
So you robbed some from the cultivators as well, did you? A little bit of that?
Well, can you repeat,
please? No, I'm just wondering whether you went in to the cultivated spots and took some pineapples and mangoes, but don't worry, I won't ask you to admit that to me on air. So here we are, not in this current novel, in The Rarest Fruit, we're talking about vanilla.
Yes.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the 1840s and the role that vanilla played in French society, I suppose, in particular, at that time. Vanilla was a very important product.
Yes, vanilla was very important for France, for Réunion Island, because it's in this island that we have discovered how to pollinate this orchid.
So at that point in time, people did not know how to hand pollinate vanilla. And your story is about this young slave who he makes this discovery. Tell us about Edmund and how he comes to be living on this plantation, on this French plantation on Réunion, or Bourbon, as it was called at that time.
Yes, indeed. Well, Edmond Albus was a young Creole boy, a black orphan, as you said, a slave who was born in La Réunion when he lived from his birth in 1829 until he died in 1880 at 51 years old. This boy was extremely lucky because he was placed into the arms of a botanist, Ferréol Bellier-Beaumont, who had a passion for orchids. Ferréol Bellier-Beaumont raised this child, Edmond Albus, as he was his own son, teaching him all he knows of the botany. Mm. And at 12 years old, this young prodigy unlocks the secret to hand-pollinating the vanilla orchids.
I'm wondering, what kind of island was it then? The fact that slavery was there tells us a lot. What kind of island did Edmund grow up in, was he born into in the 1829, when he born in 1829, in the 1830s?
Well, in the 19th century, La Réunion was a French colony with thousands of slaves who were brought in from East Africa, for instance, Mozambique. They work on sugar and coffee plantation. Slavery, racism, inequality, as I told, were normal things over there, unfortunately. And there were a few white immigrants who run this economy.
So it was the white immigrants who were making the money, but the black slaves who were doing the work.
Exactly.
So how come Edmund made this discovery? He would not have had any education, I'm guessing. He would have had very little access to education. Why was he treated so well by the plantation owner?
Well, Ferréol Bellier-Beaumont, Edmond's adoptive father and owner, teach all he knows to Edmond. He noticed that his son were keen on botany like him, as we say, like father, like son. So thus, Edmond managed to know everything about our kid.
But Ferriol, when Edmond made the discovery, and it was a very exciting moment because Ferriol then knew this is going to make us a lot of money, did he give any credit? Did he say that Edmund had done this? Did he tell others this is Edmund's discovery? Or did he take all the praise for himself?
First of all, everyone needs Edmond Albus because he was the only one who can explain, teach how to pollinate the vanilla orchid. He revolutionized not only the island's economy, but French patisserie, perfumes and more. Then his name has been totally forgotten. No rewards, no emancipation for him. Thus, my novel is a tribute to the unknown heroes of history. It deals with howling injustice and resilience. Edmund didn't get profit from it. Definitely not. While his discovery brings prosperity to many, a bitter future awaits Edmund. He died almost alone and poor, unfortunately.
Yeah, so he makes the discovery. Ferriol, the plantation owner, is making a lot of money.
Yes.
A lot of other plantation owners have been shown how to hand pollinate in this fashion. They're making money as well. Where does Edmund go? What happens to him? Immediately after he makes this discovery, he leaves the Ferriol plantation.
First of all, he stayed with Ferriol until he was 18 years old. At 18 years old, he has been he got his emancipation as all slaves in Reunion Island, and from this moment, he decided to leave Ferriol and to create his own business. Unfortunately, he didn't manage, and he spent 3 years in a prison, as you say, in a prison.
So he went to prison. What crime had he committed that sent him to prison?
As he was poor, since he didn't stay with Ferriol, he stole food, he stole jewels. That's the reason why he went in prison.
So he went into prison. But Ferriol helped, fought to have him released, to have Edmund released from prison. So there was some kind of maybe perhaps guilt on the part of Ferriol.
Yes.
That he wanted Edmund to be released. Did he help him in his later life then?
Exactly. Finally, Ferriol feels guilty because he didn't help Edmond Albus. That's the reason why he tried to send many letters in order to help Edmond Albus to come back with him in his town, that is to say Saint Suzanne in the east of Reunion Island.
So Edmund then, you said earlier, Edmund died very poor. He died in poverty, though.
Yes.
What was his situation towards the end of his life?
His situation at the end of his life was very difficult. Ferriol died before him, of course. Edmond has been married with a woman whose name is Marie-Pauline Bassana. She died too before him. And as he didn't receive any rewards, so he spent his time cultivated, grow sugar, and it was not enough for him to become rich. That's the reason why when he died, he's extremely poor.
In terms of the colonial legacy that France has left in La Réunion, how present is that colonial legacy today?
As I said at the beginning of this interview, it seems to me that it's the same thing between Great Britain and Ireland. France has recognized slavery and colonialism, but the relationships between La Réunion and France still look like the past.
Ireland has independence now at this point, so we are a totally separate country. How separate is La Réunion? Does it still depend on France for its laws, for its finances?
Yes, we still depend on France for food, for economy, for money too, for almost everything.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting... That is a big difference between here. We don't depend on Britain in that fashion. But that colonial hangover, I suppose, is quite large in terms of...
Yes, that's the reason why I thought about a modern colonialism for Réunion Island.
Well, listen, it is a fascinating story. And Edmund is quite the character. And how he didn't get more compensation for what he did, it really was a travesty, a terrible miscarriage of justice. Gael, thank you for coming in to
thank
us
you.
This evening. That's Gael Bellum. The Rarest Fruit is the title of her book. It's published by Bullon Press, and Gael will be at this year's International Literary Festival of Dublin in Merrion Square. Her talk will be at 6 p.m. tomorrow, Friday 16th of May. Full details on ilfdublin.com. Choreographer Una Doherty has returned to the Dublin Dance Festival and the Abbey Theatre with her latest production, Specky Clark. The work draws on Irish folklore and Doherty's own family history, blending elements of biography and fiction to explore themes of migration, grief and identity. Specky Clark follows the story of Doherty's great-great-grandfather as he arrives in Belfast. It all unfolds on Halloween night. Production obviously has personal significance for Doherty. Her father worked in a Belfast abattoir, and her maternal family operated a butcher shop in the city, and the great-great-grandfather. And the setting for this whole thing is partly in an abattoir. Score includes music from Lancome, and the Walsh provides the dramaturgy. I'm joined in studio this evening by Seanan McRaemin, who has been to see Specky Clark. I have to say, Una Doherty as a choreographer, first of all, Seanan, and what she has been doing with dance over the past, I guess, decade, possibly more, she really is an extraordinary voice, unique to the dance world.
I agree. She burst onto the scene virtually, literally. One of her first plays, she jumps out of the boot of a car with absolute visceral intensity. But she has been looking at subjects and using the body and movement to explore things like working class male behaviour and masculinity and... grown out of her own experiences,
yeah,
growing up as a teenager in Belfast, yeah, and all of that, but not sharply, a little, quite affectionately also.
Yeah, because so I suppose her best known piece is probably Hard to Be Soft, this idea that it's hard for a man to be soft,
yes,
and how she explores that through dance. Very interesting stuff indeed. She's telling the story of her own family here in some ways. Is that too straightforward? I don't think she'd do a family narrative. Here's my biography.
Certainly not. I think she started with the notion of her great-great-grandfather, whose kind of childhood was virtually stolen from him when he was orphaned at 10 and dispatched off to Belfast from Glasgow to stay with the Clark family, who were probably exaggerated in his own imagination, but definitely on the dysfunctional and surreal side, and was sent to work in an abattoir at 10.
Wow, as this young boy.
Yes.
And what kind of period are we talking about in history? Is that made clear to us, or could it be happening today?
Well, there are echoes of everything. I mean, the scene where the young boy is on the ship coming over across the, probably, you know, Stranraer to Larne or something, you know, with the wind and buffeting the ship. And his own terror clutching his suitcase and the ship rails and the movement. The grandfather's played by a woman dancer, young, petite, really, really fine. And so she's so small that the adults are just normal sized, so that can't...
Yes, yeah, you get a sense of adults and a child.
And a child.
Just to describe further the nature of what we're seeing on screen, an abattoir is such a, you know, frightening type of location for a piece of theatre to be set.
Yeah, I know.
So what are we looking at on stage?
Okay, so you've left the ship, you've gone to the house, and the next thing you're in an abattoir. And it is both kind of treated so kind of normal. So there are, you know, I suppose, hanging carcasses and skin. And then, but the first job he's given as his rite of passage is to shoot a pig. But the pig becomes a person and, you know, hugs him. And then.
So we're not, while the abattoir is obviously a very realistic place and a frightening place,
we are into another world entirely. I mean, she acknowledges lots of influences and they are worn very lightly, but also
what kind of
Sharpie.
What kind of influences?
Pat McCabe, The Butcher Boy, Enda Walsh, paintings of Francis Bacon as a painting of a young boy, Billy Elliot, all kinds of things. And there is this kind of parallel mixing between animals and humans. And the abattoir could also be a metaphor for a kind of killing machine, you know, the mechanization of killing, you know, his supervisor says, we'll see you on belt 4 in the morning, as if this was perfectly normal.
And we're talking about, while the setting is this abattoir for the most part, the setting is in and around Halloween night, and I suppose specifically Samhain, the Celtic festival of Samhain. How does that feed into what we're seeing on stage?
Okay, so what happens is that, you know, you have sort of references to Celtic myths and legends, which are not terribly wholesome and are certainly not comforting because they're full of blood and gore. But when Samhain, where the portal opens so that it blurs the worlds of the living and the dead, suddenly the abattoir is transformed almost into like a ballroom of romance with that, you know, that dusky red and pink light, music everywhere. And Specky, as, you know, a young boy, is brought in to this kind of carnivalesque, you know, group of people. So the dancers are representing probably figures that Doherty has carefully evoked from past history. And you're desperately trying to figure them out because she's so playful and witty. And yet it's all quite serious too. And there is one figure, you know, dressed in red, kind of sports clothes, and says devil. And then you realise that's a play on the Red Devils, and it's probably George Best. And then on a serious note, then there's a figure who's representing a tar and feathered young woman. And then there are all kinds of other people I couldn't, you know, quite figure out, but it was all,
but
costumes were fantastic.
Not figuring out who they were.
It didn't matter.
Didn't matter, yeah.
If you got
the reference, fine. If you didn't, there was...
It was nothing to do with. Yeah. It was just so evocative of how an imagination can create this fantastic scene. But the music as well.
I'm going to ask you about that. The music, Lancome are one of the main contributors to the music that accompanies the piece. What's the nature of that music? How did it? Because we are talking about a show that has text within it. We have actors speaking to us as well.
Stephen Ray is at his most kind of bleakly and comically ironic when he's, you know, let me tell you a story, you know, as if he was telling a bedtime story and you'd run a mile with what he what unfolds. But then,
and
so
that's in voiceover.
Text.
He's not on. Is Stephen
no,
is not
just
in voiceover.
Voice,
yeah.
Just his voice. There's quite enough going on.
Yeah.
You know, in the movement and in the tales that evoke your own imagination. So it, not everything needs to be played out. But the music, Lancome, is fantastic because they've two main. You know, at one stage that you can hear them doing. You know, the pride of Portbone, you know, yeah. And then you can, in the ballroom scene or in the kind of other world Samhain scene, they do this absolutely amazing adaptation of the Specials, Ghost Town, and it becomes like an anthem or a hymn, and it's just them. I mean, you forgot whoever sang it before because
it's now there.
Is that not their song? But it's, but this kind of folk ritual. She also uses a Sardinian folk singing.
Maxime Fraisse, I think,
it's called Cantu Tenore, and from Sardinia. And then they do some dancing, kind of ritual folk dancing, and then there's a bit of hip hop, and then there's a bit of jazz dancing, and they dance all together, and they dance in different places. So they just dance, as if that's the way to express.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of the music, which will give us a sense of the sort of atmosphere that it creates. That's a sense of the music. I think that Katie Cruel is featured in the performance, and that's the Lancome piece that we heard there. Shona McRaymon speaking to us about Specky Clark, the new Una Doherty dance piece. You are raving about this, and it's on now, I guess, and tomorrow and Saturday. The only two nights left to see
two
it.
Two nights left, but that's great to have four nights, you know, because in festivals, you know, very often it's only one or two, but it would be an hour well spent, is all I can say, just for the imaginative, fantastic dancing, the music. It's operatic, really, and surreal, and magic realism, and everything else thrown in.
Shona McRaymon there speaking to us about Specky Clark, the new Una Doherty show that is part of the Dublin Dance Festival. It's at the Abbey Theatre, runs through until Saturday. You can find out details of it and everything else happening at the festival on dublindancefestival.ie. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Mullen was on sound tonight. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. And the programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.